This is the BBC Home Service. Saturday Night Theatre. We present The Mystery of Edwin Drood, the unfinished novel by Charles Dickens, adapted for broadcasting with a suggested ending by Molly Hardwick. The story will be told with the words of Charles Dickens by Francis DeWolfe. The Mystery of Edwin Drood begins with the voice of John Jasper, to be played by John Gabriel, as he dreams through opium in the meanest and closest of small rooms, while the light of early day steals in from a miserable court somewhere in London's Dockland.
Ancient English cathedral tower. How can an ancient English cathedral tower be here? There's no spike of rusty iron in the air between the eye and it. What is the spike that intervenes? Maybe it is set up by the Sultan's orders for the impaling of a horde of Turkish robbers one by one. It is so. For cymbals clash and the Sultan goes by to his palace in long procession. 10,000 scimitars flash in the sunlight and thrice 10,000 dancing girls strew flowers. The cathedral tower rises in the background where it cannot be. And still no writhing figure is on the grim spike. Stay! Is the spike so low a thing as the rusty spike on the top of a post of an old bedstead that has tumbled all awry?
Yes, an old bedstead that has given way under the weight upon it. The man who now returns from fantastic dreams to consciousness lies across this large, unseemly bed, fully dressed. Also across the bed lie a Chinaman, a Lascar, and a haggard, sluttish woman. The first two in a trance of opium, the last blowing at a kind of pipe to kindle it.
Another, dearie. Have another.
No more. No more.
You smoked as many as five of me pipes since you come in at midnight. There's another ready for you, dearie.
Don't want any more.
Makes me pots of old penny in bottles, you see, dearie. Here, this is one, and I fits in a mouthpiece this way, and I takes me mixture out of this thimble with this little horn spoon, and so I fills, dearie. Here, here's your pipe. Takes away the hunger, as well as wickles, dearie.
Well, take it away, don't want it.
Thou on Prince's Puffer's pipes.
Princess Puffer asleep already. Dreaming already. What visions can she have, I wonder? What visions compared with mine?
The true secret.
Unintelligible. Quite unintelligible. And so? Good day to you, my fine companions.
Unintelligible, eh? Princess Puffer, unintelligible. Don't ye be too sure, always. Don't ye be too sure, my beauty.
That same afternoon, the massive grey square tower of an old cathedral rises before the sight of a jaded traveller. The bells are going for daily vesper service, and he must needs attend it, one would say, from his haste to reach the open cathedral door. The choir are getting on their white robes when he arrives among them, gets on his own robe in a hurry, and falls into the procession, filing into service. A city of a bygone time is Cloisterham, with its hoarse cathedral bell, its hoarse rooks hovering about the cathedral tower, and its hoarser and less distinct rooks in the stalls far beneath. The day is waning, and the year. The Virginia creeper on the cathedral wall has showered half its deep red leaves down on the pavement. Some of these leaves, in a timid rush, seek sanctuary within the low-arched cathedral door. But two men coming out resist them and cast them forth again with their feet. This done, one of the two, Mr. Tope the verger, locks the door with a goodly key, and the other, the choirmaster, flits away with a folio music book.
Mr. Tope!
Yes, Mr. Dean?
Was that our choirmaster, Mr. Jasper, whom Canon Crisparkle and I saw leaving you just now?
Yes, Mr. Dean, it was Mr. Jasper.
He has stayed late, has he not?
Yes, Your Reverence. During the service, he had been took a little poorly.
Tope, say taken to the Dean.
And when and how has Mr. Jasper been taken? For, as Canon Crisparkle has remarked, it is better to say taken. And when and how has Mr. Jasper been taken poorly, Tope?
Why, sir, Mr. Jasper was that breathed.
I wouldn't say that breathed, Tope, to the Dean. Not English.
A breathe to that extent would be preferable, Tope.
Mr. Jasper's breathing was so remarkably short, sir, when he came into service, that it distressed him mightily to get his notes out, which was perhaps the cause of his having a kind of fit on him after a little.
A fit? Dear, dear.
His memory grew dazed, sir, and a dimness and giddiness crept over him as strange as ever I saw. However, a little time and a little water soon brought him out of it.
And Mr. Jasper has now gone home quite himself, has he?
Yes, Your Reverence, he has now gone home quite himself.
Is Mr. Jasper's nephew, a young Mr. Drood, with him?
No, sir, but expected.
Well, I hope Mr. Jasper's heart may not be too much set upon his nephew. Our affections, however laudable in this transitory world, should never master us. We should guide them. Perhaps, Canon Crisparkle, you will, before going home, look in on Mr. Jasper.
Certainly, Mr. Dean, with pleasure. Good evening, Jasper. Sorry to hear from Tope that you were not too well during the service.
Oh, it was nothing, my dear Crisparkle. Tope has made too much of it, I suspect. It's his trade to make the most of everything appertaining to the cathedral, you know.
Yes, indeed. Then I may tell the Dean that you are all right again?
Certainly, with my respects and thanks to the Dean. You will stay and take a glass of wine with me.
Thank you, no. I must be on my way. I'm glad to hear that you expect your nephew, young Edwin Drood. When does he arrive?
I expect the dear fellow every moment. Certainly he'll be here by dinner time.
Excellent, excellent. He'll do more good than a doctor.
Be gone, dull care. I prithee be gone from me. Be gone, dull care. You and I shall never agree. Long time hast thou been tarrying here, and fain thou wouldst me kill. But if faith, dull care, thou never shall have thy will. Too much care will make a young man turn grey. And too much care will turn an old man to clay. My wife shall dance and I will sing so merrily pass the day. But I hold it one of the wisest things to drive dull care away.
Now let us drink a toast.
My dear uncle, your very good health.
And yours, Ned. I drink to your welcome visit.
I say, this is excellent sherry, you know. You've certainly done me proud tonight. Uncle?
Yes, Ned, my boy?
Tell me, do you really and truly feel as if our relationship divided us at all? I don't.
Well, Ned, uncles as a rule are so much older than their nephew that I have that feeling instinctively.
As a rule, I may be. But what's the difference in age of half a dozen years or so? And some uncles in large families are even younger than their nephews. By George, I wish it was the case with us.
Do you, Ned? Why?
Because if it was, I'd take the lead with you and be as wise as the old song, Begone, dull care, will make a young man turn grey. And begone, dull care, will turn an old man to clay. I say, let's have another toast.
What toast?
He asked, what toast on Pussy's birthday, and no happy returns proposed. To Pussy, Uncle, and many of them. Happy returns, I mean.
To Rosa.
Yes, to Pussy. And now, Uncle, let's have a little talk about my betrothed. How is Pussy looking?
Very like your sketch of her up there.
Yes. I am a little proud of that, you know. But then I ought to have caught that scornful, pert expression of hers pretty well. For I've seen it often enough. I see it whenever I go to see her. If I don't find it on her face when I arrive, I leave it there when I go. I say...
Yes, Ned?
Don't you think it's unsatisfactory to be cut off from choice in such a matter?
Eh?
As marrying, I mean. If I could choose, I choose Pussy from all the pretty girls in the world.
But you have not got to choose.
That's what I complain of. My dead and gone father and Pussy's dead and gone father must needs marry us together by anticipation. Why the devil couldn't they leave us alone?
Oh, tut, tut, dear boy.
Tut, tut, yes, Uncle. It's all very well for you. You can take it easily. You live a quiet life.
A quiet life?
Your life is not laid down to scale and lined and dotted out for you like a surveyor's plan.
Oh.
You can choose your...
Don't stop, dear fellow. Go on.
What's the matter? Have I somehow hurt your feelings?
How can you hurt my feelings?
Good heavens, Uncle. You look frightfully ill. There's a strange film come over your eyes.
I've been taking opium for pain and agony that sometimes overcomes me.
Opium?
Yes, the effects of it steal over me like a blight or a cloud that pass. They'll be gone directly. Look away from me, they'll go all the sooner. There. I'm better now. You were saying a little while ago what a quiet life mine is. It is so. I hate it.
Hate it, Uncle?
I hate it. The cramped monotony of my existence grinds me away by the grain. How does our cathedral service sound to you?
Beautiful. Quite celestial.
It often sounds to me quite devilish. I'm so weary of it. Echoes of my own voice among the arches seem to mock me with my daily drudging round.
I thought you had so exactly found your niche in life.
I know you thought so. They all think so. Anyhow, my dear Ned, I must subdue myself to my vocation. It's too late to find another now. This is a confidence between us, eh?
It shall be sacredly preserved.
And you will remember?
My dear uncle, I ask you, am I likely to forget what you said with so much feeling?
Take it as a warning, then.
As a warning? My dear uncle, believe me, I do appreciate that the state of mind you describe is painful and hard to bear. But let me reassure you, there's no chance of it overcoming me. In less than a year, you know, I shall carry Pussy off from school as Mrs. Edwin Drood and go off engineering to the East, to Egypt. And then, to quote the old song I was singing at dinner, my wife shall dance and I shall sing so merrily past the day. And I hold it one of the wisest things.
You won't be warned, then.
No, no.
You can't be warned.
No, Uncle, not by you. I don't really consider myself in danger.
Then, shall we go and take our walk in the churchyard, Ned?
In the midst of Cloisterham stands the Nun's House, a venerable brick edifice. On the trim gate enclosing its old courtyard is a resplendent brass plate flashing forth the legend, Seminary for Young Ladies, Miss Twinkleton. The pet pupil of the Nun's House is Miss Rosa Budd, of course called Rosebud, and known to her fiancé Edwin Drood as Pussy. Hers is the childish beauty of the portraits in Jasper's room, the flowing brown hair and the captivating look of saucy discontent, comically conscious of itself. This expression has become particularly obvious since Miss Twinkleton's chief parlourmaid announced the arrival of Mr. Edwin Drood to see Miss Budd.
No, Eddie, don't come any nearer, please. It is so absurd.
What is absurd, Rosa?
The whole thing is. It is so absurd to be an engaged orphan and have the girls and the servants scuttling about after one like mice in the wainscot. It is so absurd to be called upon.
Well, I must say you give me an affectionate reception.
I will in a minute, Eddie, but I can't just yet. How are you? Shake hands. No, I can't kiss you because I've got an acidulated drop in my mouth.
Are you at all glad to see me, Pussy?
Yes, I'm dreadfully glad.
Perhaps we'd better stop short, Rosa.
Oh, Eddie, you know we must be married and married from here, or the poor girls will be so dreadfully disappointed.
Well, it seems, according to custom, we can't get on. Rosa, there isn't any other young man.
Oh, no, Eddie. It's generous of you to ask me, but no.
Oh, then that's clear, at any rate. Shall I take you out for a walk, Rosa, dear?
Oh, yes, Eddie. Let's go for a walk. I want to go to the Lumps of Delight shop.
To the...
Lumps of Delight is a Turkish sweetmeat. My gracious me, don't you understand anything? Call yourself an engineer and not know that.
Well, how should I know it, Rosa?
Because I'm very fond of them, that's how. Here, take your old stick and your gloves. Eddie?
Yes?
Why are you studying my palm so intently? What can you see in my hand, Eddie? In the lines?
See? Why, nothing. What should I see?
I thought you Egyptian boys could look into a hand and see all sorts of phantoms. Can't you see a happy future, Eddie? do say you can see a happy future, Edith.
Edwin's inquiry as to the possibility of another young gentleman's presence in Miss Budd's affections had been truthfully answered. And nevertheless, it was not long before Rose's charms made an immediate and strong impression upon the heart of another young gentleman, none other than Neville Landless, who, with his twin sister Helena, had arrived to visit Canon Crisparkle. They were an unusually handsome pair, much alike, both very dark and very rich in colour. There was something untamed about them both, a certain air upon them of hunter and huntress. And yet they bore a certain air of being the objects of the chase rather than the followers. An unhappy childhood in Ceylon, in the household of a cruel stepfather, had partially embittered the character of Neville, as he soon confided to his host.
The truth is, Canon Crisparkle, my sister Helena and I came here to quarrel with you and affront you and break away again.
Really?
Having liked no one else with whom we have ever been brought into contact, we had made up our minds not to like you.
Really?
We do like you, sir. And we see an unmistakable difference between your house and your reception of us and anything else we have ever known.
Ah.
This and everything round us seeming so quiet and peaceful, and Cloisterham being so old and grave and beautiful with the moon shining on it. These things inclined me to open my heart to you.
I quite understand, Mr. Neville.
I should like you to know that my sister Helena has come out of the disadvantages of our miserable life as much better than I am, as that cathedral tower is higher than those chimneys. Nothing ever subdued her, though it often cowed me.
Indeed.
When we ran away from our miserable surroundings, the flight was always of her planning and leading. Each time she dressed as a boy...
Dressed as a boy?
Yes, and showed the daring of a man.
I'm sure that Miss Landless's courage is only equaled by her beauty and amiability. I hope and trust you will both find many friends in Cloisterham.
Canon Crisparkle's pious hope was not, it appeared, to be entirely fulfilled, as was to be seen at the music party held that evening in Mr. Jasper's drawing room. Mr. Landless's eyes seldom left Rosa's face as she sang to the piano accompaniment of Mr. Jasper. Mr. Drood's eyes occasionally strayed to the dark, lustrous ones of Helena Landless. The party being concluded, and the young ladies escorted back to the nun's house, where Helena was to be a pupil, Neville and Edwin returned to the gatehouse together, walking up the windy street and talking as they went.
Do stay here long, Mr. Drood.
No, not this time. I leave for London again tomorrow, but I shall be here off and on till I leave England.
Are you going abroad, then?
Going to wake up Egypt a little. Engineering.
Indeed. I heard from Canon Crisparkle of your other good fortune.
Oh, what good fortune?
I hope there is no offence in my referring to your betrothal.
By George, everybody in this chattering old cloister refers to it.
I'm not accountable for Canon Crisparkle's mentioning the matter to me openly.
No, true, you're not.
I am accountable for mentioning it to you. I had mentioned it in supposing that you could not fail to be highly proud of it.
I don't know that what people are proudest of, they most like other people to talk about.
It doesn't seem to me very civil in you.
Perhaps the best civility is to mind one's own business.
The strained atmosphere between the two young men does not escape Mr. Jasper's notice when they return to his lodging. He bids them be reconciled and pours oil in the form of excellent mulled wine upon the troubled waters. But it seems to require much mixing and compounding.
Look at him. See where my nephew Edwin Drood lounges so easily, Mr. Neville. A life of domestic ease and love before him, eh, Ned?
It might have been better for Mr. Drood to have known some hardships.
Pray, why might it have been better for Mr. Drood to have known some hardships?
Yes, Mr. Neville, tell us why.
Because they might have made him more sensible of good fortune that is not necessarily the result of his own merits.
Have you known hardships, may I ask?
I have.
And what have they made you sensible of?
I've told you once before tonight.
You have done nothing of the sort.
I tell you I have. That you take a great deal too much upon yourself.
You added something else to that, if I remember.
Yes, I did say something else.
Say it again.
I said that in the part of the world I come from, you would be called to account for it.
Only there. A long way off, I believe, at a safe distance.
Here, then. Anywhere. You're a common fellow and a common boaster.
Am I, indeed?
Why, you're
there, Mr. Neville, for shame. Give that glass to me. Ned, my dear fellow, do not, I pray you, give way to this unbridled passion.
Thank you.
It is the custom of Canon Crisparkle to sit up last of the early household at Minor Canon Corner, very softly touching his piano. The south wind that goes where it lists by way of Minor Canon Corner on a still night is not more subdued than Canon Crisparkle at such times. Tonight, his gentle music making is disturbed by a soft knock at the outer door.
Mr. Jasper, you are a late visitor.
I brought back Mr. Lovell Landis's hat. He left it behind him at my lodgings.
I see, thank you.
He has returned, I presume?
Yes, he's been in his room this half hour.
We've had an awful scene with him, Canon Crisparkle.
I gathered something of it. Was it so bad as that, then?
Murderous.
No, Jasper, do not use such strong words.
He might have laid my dear nephew dead at my feet. No fault of his that he did not, but that I was, through the mercy of God, swift and strong with him, he would have cut him down on my hearth.
I am deeply distressed to hear it.
Seeing what I've seen tonight and hearing what I've heard, I shall never know peace of mind when there is danger of those two coming together. It was horrible. There is something of the tiger in Landless's dark blood.
Meanwhile, in the chaste precincts of the nun's house, a happier relationship was blossoming between Neville's sister Helena and Rosa Budd.
Helena, you will be my friend and help me. I don't understand myself, and I want a friend who can understand me very much indeed.
Of course, Rosa, my dear. I will help you all I can. Rosa?
Yes?
Tell me, who is Mr. Jasper?
Eddie's uncle and my music master.
You don't love him?
Love Mr. Jasper? Oh.
You know that he loves you, Rosa.
Oh, don't. He terrifies me. He haunts my thoughts like a dreadful ghost. I feel I'm never safe from him.
My dear child, you speak as if it threatened you in some way.
He has never spoken to me about that, never.
What has he done, then?
He has made a slave of me with his looks. When I play upon the piano, he never moves his eyes from my hands. And when I sing, he never moves his eyes from my lips. I avoid his eyes, but he forces me to see them without looking at them. Tonight, when he watched my lips so closely as I was singing, besides feeling terrified, I felt ashamed and passionately hurt.
I understand.
It was as if he kissed me, and I couldn't bear it, but cried out and broke off the song. Oh, Helena, stay with me.
My dear.
I'm too frightened to be left by myself.
I'll stay with you, Rosa, dear, as long as you need me.
Shortly after the unlucky quarrel between Edwin Drood and Neville Landless, and while its echoes still resounded about the nun's house, Rosa received a visit from her guardian, Mr. Grugis. He was an arid, sandy man, who, if he'd been put into a grinding mill, looked as if he would have ground immediately into high-dried snuff. With an awkward and hesitating manner, a shambling walk, and a near sight, Mr. Grugis still had some strange capacity in him of making, on the whole, an agreeable impression.
My dear Miss Rosa, how do you do? I'm glad to see you.
And I to see you, Mr. Grugis.
My visits are like those of the angels. Not that I compare myself to an angel.
No, sir.
Not by any means. I merely refer to the fact that my visits are few and far between. You are well and happy, my dear. You look so.
Yes, indeed, thank you.
Good. And that is the first item about which I made a memorandum to ask you. For I have no conversational powers whatever. Now, Miss Rosa, pounds, shillings, and pence. Yes, pounds, shillings, and pence. The dry subject for a young lady. You find your allowance always sufficient for your wants, my dear.
Perfectly, thank you, sir.
Good, excellent. Now, what have we next? Ah, marriage. Marriage. Now touch, my dear, upon the point that is the direct cause of my troubling you with this present visit.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Edwin Drood has been to and fro here as was arranged. You have mentioned that in your letters to me. And you like him, and he likes you.
I like him very much.
So I said, my dear, so I said. Good. All goes well, then.
Mr. Grugis, will you please tell me something?
If I can, my dear Miss Rosa.
My poor papa and Eddie's father made their agreement together about our marriage for the lasting good and happiness of both of us. Isn't that so?
Just so.
It was not bound upon either of us by any forfeit in case...
Now, don't be agitated, my dear. In the case of your not marrying one another, no forfeiture on either side. Two young people can only be betrothed in marriage of their own free will, their own assurance that they are suited to each other and will make each other happy. There, does that satisfy you?
I think so, thank you.
Is the young gentleman expected shortly?
Oh, he has gone away only this morning. He will be back at Christmas. And Could I ask you most kindly to come to me at Christmas if I had anything particular to say to you?
Why, certainly, certainly. I should be quite proud of your wishing to see me, my dear. As a professional receiver of rent, so very few people do wish to see me. The novelty would be bracing.
Before leaving Cloisterham, Mr. Grewgious called upon Mr. Jasper and communicated to him the gist of his interview with Rosa.
You settled with her that you would come back at Christmas?
Yes, Mr. Jasper.
I see. I am to understand, then, that at Christmas my nephew and Miss Budd will complete their preparations for their wedding in May.
That is my understanding. God bless them both.
God save them both.
I said bless them.
I said save them. Is there any difference?
As befitting one residing in a cathedral city, Mr. Jasper is an avowed lover of the picturesque and antique. It is no doubt this enthusiasm which prompts him to arrange a moonlight exploration of the cathedral's tombs, vaults, towers, and ruins in the company of Durdles, the stonemason, a character known in Cloisterham as a wonderful workman, which, for all that everybody knows he may be, but he never works, and a wonderful sot, which everybody knows he is. With the cathedral crypt, he is better acquainted than any living authority, which acquaintance began in his resorting to that secret place to sleep off the fumes of liquor. It is about moonrise when Mr. Jasper meets this stone-coloured figure in the churchyard.
Durdles.
Coming, Mr. Jasper.
Are you ready?
I'm ready, Mr. Jasper. Let the old uns come out of their tombs if they dare. My spirit's ready for them.
Do you mean animal spirits or ardent?
The one's the t'other, and I mean them both.
Wiggy, wiggy, wake up, warning. Yo!
You boy. Why are you throwing stones at this man?
Because I'm making a top shy of him.
Give me those stones in your hand.
Yeah, I'll give a gang a threat if you can't catch him out of me.
Baby devil that you are, what has this man done to you?
He won't go home.
And what's that to you?
Well, he gives him a life and he's a petty mum if I catch him out too late. That's why I sing, wiggy wiggy when I catch him out of the tent. Wiggy wiggy why, then he don't go firm or shy. Wiggy wiggy why, cop warning.
Come here, you old oh, fighter. Let be, Mr. Jasper, let be. He's only doing his duty.
Why, you know this thing, this child?
Oh, it's Deputy.
Deputy, that its name.
Oh, I'm a manservant up at the Traveller's Company and Gasworks Guarding. All that manservants at Travellers' Lodgings named Deputy. When we're chock full and the Travellers is all abed, I come out from the elf.
Be off with you or I'll kill you.
Weedy, weedy, when I'll catch you, then how's all the time? Weedy, weedy, why? Then he jumps up there,
now, perhaps we can proceed with our expedition, Durdles. Hold up the lantern. You had better take care of this bottle, which I took the precaution of bringing in case the night turned chilly.
Aye, aye. Nothing like it for keeping the cold out. I'll look after it. Steady. Where that mound by the yard gate, Mr. Jasper?
I see it. What is it?
That's lime, that is.
Lime? What you call quick lime?
Aye. Quick enough to eat your boots. With a little handy stirring, quick enough to eat your bones.
Is it indeed? What are you doing with that hammer, pray?
I'm tapping for old uns. That's what I'm doing. Finding them out in their tombs, you see.
How very curious and interesting.
As you pitch your notes, so I sound for mine. I take my hammer and I tap. Sorry, I go on tapping. Sorry still, tap again. All right. There you are. Old un crumbled away in stone coffin. In vault.
Astonishing.
For instance, 6 foot inside that wall is Mrs. Sapsey, the mayor's wife, dead 9 months since. That's the Sapsey vault, that is. And the keys here in my pocket until Mrs. Sapsey's inscription's finished.
But you're not putting the inscription inside the vault, surely, Durdles?
Durdles knows where it's to be put, Mr. Jasper. No man better. And inside or outside? Durdles likes to look at his work all round and see that his work is a-doing him credit.
Very right and proper. May I see this key out of mere curiosity?
No reason why not. Here. It's a good weight, as you can feel.
Remarkably heavy. There, take it.
I see we're approaching the crypt. Hold your lantern higher, or we may miss our footing on the steps.
They go into the crypt, where the taciturnity of Durdles is for the time overcome by Mr. Jasper's wicker bottle, which circulates freely. Then they ascend the steps to the great tower, pausing halfway up for further acquaintance with the wicker bottle, which has now passed into Durdles' keeping entirely. Up they go, turning, turning, sometimes looking down into the moonlit nave, until at the top they look down on Cloisterham. Then they descend into the crypt again, on the way to which Durdles is unaccountably overcome with drowsiness. Is it the effect of Mr. Jasper's wine in the wicker bottle? And begs Mr. Jasper's permission for 40 winks.
By all means. Take your nap if you must. I'll just walk to and fro.
Durdles dreams, and his dream is unusually real. He dreams of lying there, asleep, and yet counting his companion's footsteps as he walks to and fro. He dreams that the footsteps die away into distance, and that something touches him, and that something falls from his hand. Then something clinks and gropes about, and he dreams he is alone for a long time. Then he wakes, suddenly and unmeaningly alarmed.
Two o'clock? Why didn't you try to wake me, Mr. Jasper?
I did. I might as well have tried to wake the dead. Well, are you quite ready?
Wakey, wakey, when?
What? Is that baby devil on the watch there? I'll shed his blood.
Come here, you little imp of hell.
Let go of me. Oh, blind you, swap me. Oh, stone your eyes out, swap me. Oh, let me go.
Don't hurt the boy, Mr. Jasper.
He followed us tonight when we first came here.
You lie, I didn't.
And he's been prowling near us ever since.
You lie, I haven't. Only just come out for me elf when I see you were coming out.
Take him home, then. Let my eyes be rid of the sight of him.
Yes, Mr. Jasper. Come on, you.
Behind the most ancient part of Holborn, London, is a little nook called Staple Inn, one of those nooks where a few smoky sparrows twitter in smoky trees as though they call to one another, "Let us play at country." Here, one December afternoon, sat Mr. Grewgious writing by his fire, and was roused from his work by the entrance of Bazzard, his clerk, a pale, puffy-faced person, whom Mr. Grewgious nevertheless treated with unaccountable consideration.
Well, well, Bazzard, what is in the wind besides fog?
Mr. Drew.
What of him?
Has called.
Well, you might have shown him in.
I am doing so. Mr. Drew.
Good evening to you, Mr. Grewgious.
How do you do, Mr. Edwin? Oh, dear me, you're choking.
It's this fog. It makes my eyes smart like cayenne pepper.
Is it really so bad as that? Pray undo your wrappers.
Oh, thank you.
It's fortunate I have so good a fire. But Mr. Bazzard has taken care of me.
No, I haven't.
Ah, then it follows that I must have taken care of myself without observing it. Pray be seated, Mr. Drood, in my chair. The fog may clear in an hour or two, and then we can have dinner sent in from just across Holborn. And I'll ask Bazzard. He mightn't like it else. Bazzard?
Sir?
Dine presently with Mr. Drood and me.
If I'm ordered to dine, of course I will.
Save the man. You're not ordered, you're invited.
Thank you, sir. In that case, I don't care if I do.
That's arranged, then. And perhaps you wouldn't mind stepping over to the hotel in Furnival's and asking them to send over dinner. Tell them I want a joint, such as a haunch of mutton, and a goose or a turkey or any little stuffed thing of that sort. In short, we'll have whatever there is on hand.
Very good, sir. I'll go straight away.
Thank you, Bazzard. I have to be a little delicate about employing Bazzard in the foraging department, Mr. Drood. He mightn't like it, you see.
He seems to have his own way, sir.
His own way? Oh, dear, no. Poor fellow, you quite mistake him. If he had his own way, he wouldn't be here.
Indeed, sir, where would he?
Now, Mr. Edwin, if I may, I take it without having the gift of prophecy that you have looked in on me to mention that you're going down to Cloisterham.
Yes, sir.
I've been down there myself lately, and I know you're expected.
I knew that Pussy was looking out for me.
Do you keep a cat down there, then?
Oh, no, I call Rosa Pussy.
Oh, really? That's very affable.
A pet name, sir. Did Rosa...
Rosa?
I was going to say Pussy and change my mind. Did she tell you anything about the Landesses?
No. What is the Landesses? An estate? A villa? farm?
A brother and sister.
Oh.
The sister, Helena, is at the nun's house and has become a great friend of poor...
Prosa's. No, the landlesses were not mentioned.
The waiters, sir, are here to prepare the table.
Ah, good, good. Then we'll postpone our business until after dinner, Mr. Edwin.
Very well.
Now, what kind of soup are they bringing us, I wonder? I rather fancy turkey. Very well, sir. I drink to you. A toast, Bazzard.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Edwin, success to Mr. Bazzard.
Success to Mr. Bazzard?
I thank you both, gentlemen.
Now, I devote a bumper to the fair and fascinating Miss Rosa.
Miss Rosa?
To Rosa.
And now, Mr. Edwin, to a little piece of business.
Hmm?
Let's draw our chairs back and be comfortable. Never mind Bazzard. He's asleep over there. He will be in a minute. Now, you see this drawer? In here, I have a ring, Mr. Edwin.
Yes, sir.
Diamonds and rubies, delicately set in gold. This ring was given to Miss Rosa's mother by her husband when they were first betrothed. On his deathbed, he gave it to me with the trust that when yours and Miss Rosa's betrothal was coming to maturity, I should give it to you to place upon her finger.
Thank you. I will take the greatest care of it.
I'm a particularly angular man, Mr. Edwin, and may be presumed to know little of a true lover's state of mind. But I figure to myself that there can be no coolness, no lassitude, no doubt, no indifference, no half-fire and half-smoke state of mind in a real lover. Pray, am I at all near the mark?
I should say, sir, since you refer the question to me, that you may be rather hard upon the unlucky lover.
Likely so. I'm a hard man in the grain. Now for our witness. Bazzard.
Sir?
In discharge of a trust, I have handed Mr. Edwin Drood a ring of diamonds and rubies. You see?
I see, sir. And I witnessed the transaction.
Yes. And now, Mr. Edwin,
mm-hmm.
If anything should be amiss, yes. Even slightly wrong, between you and Miss Rosa, if you should have any secret consciousness that you are committing yourself to this step, for no higher reason than that you have been long accustomed to look forward to it, then I charge you once more, by the living and by the dead, to bring that ring back to me.
It is Christmas Eve. Red berries shine here and there in the lattices of Minor Canon Corner. Edwin has this morning returned to Cloisterham, and tonight he is to attend a dinner party at his Uncle Jasper's lodging, at which he will have the opportunity of making his peace with Neville Landless. It is of this, and of his uncle's remarkable good nature in bringing them together, that he thinks as he saunters through the ancient city. Finding that his watch has stopped, he turns into a jeweler's to have it mended.
There, sir. I've set it for you. 2:20. Let me recommend you not to let it run down, sir.
Thank you, I remember that.
Anything else I can show you, sir? Necklace? What about this bracelet now? Very neat and charming. Delightful for a lady, Mr. Drood. Especially one of a rather diminutive style of beauty, you might say. Look well on a young bride's arm, this would, Mr. Drood.
Thank you, I don't want to make any purchases at the moment.
This tray of gentlemen's rings now. Here's a very chaste design. A very responsible appearance, has this signet, Mr. Drood. What handsome a memento of his wedding day could a gentleman have, with the date engraved inside? Now, I ask you.
Yes, very handsome, I'm sure, but I wear no jewelry but my watch and chain and this shirt pin.
Why, I'm aware of that, sir.
Oh.
Yes, for Mr. Jasper dropped in for a watch glass the other day, and I showed these articles to him, remarking that if he should wish to make a present to any gentleman relative on any particular occasion, but he said, smiling, like, that he had an inventory in his mind of all the jewelry his gentleman relative ever wore.
Yes, no doubt. My uncle takes an extraordinary interest in my turnout. I believe if I made an extra crease in my neckcloth, he'd notice it. Good day to you.
Good day, Mr. Drood. Don't forget to wind the watch.
On leaving the jeweler's, Edwin made his way towards the nun's house. His mind was uneasy about the forthcoming interview with Rosa. But for Mr. Grewgious' solemn charge to him and the ring that now lay in his breast pocket,
he would have drifted into marriage without a thought. He resolved to be guided by whatever Rosa herself might say as they walked that afternoon by the river.
My dear Eddie, I want to say something very serious to you. I've been thinking about it for a long, long time.
I want to be serious with you too, Rosa, dear.
Thank you, Eddie. Eddie, let us be brave. Let us change to brother and sister from this day forth.
And never be husband and wife, Rosa?
Never. Oh, Eddie, dear, I'm so sorry.
And I'm deeply sorry too, Rosa. Deeply sorry for you.
And I for you, Eddie, my dear brother. Oh, but Eddie, the dear girls will be so dreadfully disappointed. They've looked forward to it so, poor pet.
But I'm afraid it will be a worse disappointment to my uncle.
Oh, but he has so little to do with it, hasn't he?
My dear child, my uncle is so wrapped up in me that he can't fail to be struck all of a heap by such a sudden and complete change in my life. How shall I tell him?
My guardian, Mr. Grewgious, is coming down to Cloisterham today. Would you like to leave it to him?
A bright idea. The other trustee. Nothing more natural. He comes down, he goes to my uncle, he relates what we've agreed upon, and he states our case better than we could. That's it. I'm not a coward, Rosa, but to tell you a secret, I am a little afraid of my uncle.
No, no, you're not afraid of him.
Why, Rosa, my dear girl, what's the matter?
I'm sorry, you alarmed me. I'm a silly little thing, you know, Eddie.
You're shivering. Shall I take you home?
The river looks so dark. The sun's gone behind a cloud. Yes. Let us go home, Eddie.
You know we have done right, Rosa.
Yes.
We know it's better so even now.
Yes, Eddie. God bless you, dear. Goodbye.
God bless you, dear. Give me the last kiss of our betrothal.
There. Now, please take me home, Eddie, and let me be by myself.
Don't look round, Rosa. But didn't you see my uncle? Under the trees. He was watching us, I think. Poor fellow. He little thinks we've parted.
Has he followed us? Is he behind?
No. Yes, he is. The dear, sympathetic old fellow likes to keep us in sight. I'm afraid he'll be bitterly disappointed. Bitterly disappointed.
Edwin strolls about the town to pass the time until the dinner hour, the hour of the party at his uncle's lodgings. As dusk draws on, he paces the monk's vineyard. Suddenly he becomes aware of a figure crouching on the ground. The figure of a woman of haggard appearance, her weazened chin resting on her hands and her eyes staring before her.
Are you ill, Mother?
No, dearie.
Are you blind? Then what's the matter that you stay here in the cold so long?
My lungs is weakly, dearie. My lungs is bad.
I'm sorry. Where do you come from?
From London, dearie. I came here looking for a needle in a haystack and I ain't found it. Here, look here, dearie, give me 3 and 6 pence and don't you be afeard for me.
Your eyes are like someone else's. Do you eat opium?
I smokes it, dearie. Give me 3 and 6pence and I'll lay it out well and tell you something into the bargain.
Here you are, then. Now, what have you to tell me?
Bless you, dear gentleman. What's your christened name?
Edwin, why?
Edwin, is that the short of that name, Eddie?
It's sometimes called so, yes.
Well, don't sweethearts call it so?
How should I know?
Oh, haven't you a sweetheart upon your soul?
None, I assure you.
Oh, goodbye to you then, and bless you, and thank you, dearie.
But come back. You were going to tell me something.
Yeah, I was. So I was. Well, then, you be thankful that your name ain't Ned.
Why?
Because it's a bad name to have just now.
How a bad name?
A threatened name is Ned. A dangerous name.
The proverb says that threatened men live long.
Well, then, wherever this Ned may be while I'm talking to you, he should live to all eternity. Bless you, dearie. Thank you.
Edwin makes for the better lighted streets and resolves as he walks on to say nothing of this tonight but to mention it tomorrow to his uncle, who alone calls him Ned. An odd coincidence. Of course, only a coincidence, and not anything better worth remembering. Still, it holds to him, as many things much better worth remembering never did. He walks over the bridge and by the river, and the woman's words are in the rising wind, in the angry sky, in the troubled water, in the flickering lights.
Thank you.
There is some solemn echo of these words, even in the cathedral chime, which strikes a sudden surprise to his heart as he turns in under the archway of the gatehouse. And so he goes up the postern stair. Not very far away, Neville and Helena Landless walk together and discuss the walking tour which Neville proposes to begin on the following morning, so that, as he says, he may take himself out of everybody's way.
I shall travel like a pilgrim, Helena, with wallet and staff. My knapsack is packed, and here's my staff.
What a heavy, clumsy stick. What's it made of? I don't recognize the wood.
Oh, iron wood, I believe. How dark the sky is getting. I wish I weren't going to this dinner at Jasper's, Helena.
Neville, dear, is it worthwhile to care so much about it? Think how soon it will be over.
Yes, I know. But I don't like it.
Well, there may be some awkwardness, I know, between you and Mr. Drood. But it will only be for a moment. You're quite sure of yourself now.
I wish I felt as sure of everything else as I feel of myself.
How strangely you speak, Neville. What do you mean?
Helena, I don't know. I only know that I don't like it. What a strange dead weight there is in the air.
Look how those copper-colored clouds are scudding across the sky. That means the wind is rising. The air will clear soon.
Will it? I wonder.
He leaves her at the gate of the nun's house. She does not immediately enter, but remains looking after him along the street. Twice he passes the gatehouse, reluctant to enter. At length, with a rapid turn, he hurries in. And so he goes up the postern stair. Mr. Jasper is in beautiful voice at Vespers. In the pathetic supplication to have his heart made clean within him, he quite astonishes his fellows by his melodious power.
O God, make clean our hearts within us.
His throat must be a little tender, for he wears a large black scarf of strong, close-woven silk slung loosely round his neck as he comes out from the cathedral and makes his way to the gatehouse. There, arriving under the archway, he pauses for a moment in the shadows to pull off his scarf and hang it in a loop upon his arm. For an instant, his face is frowning and stern. Then it clears as he resumes his way. And so he goes up the postern stair. That night, a great storm rises and shakes Cloisterham. No such power of wind has blown for many a winter night. Chimneys topple in the streets, and people hold to posts and corners and to one another to keep themselves upon their feet. The violence of wind comes in fury until at midnight, when the streets are empty, the storm goes thundering and rattling along them, rattling at all the latches and tearing at all the shutters, as if warning the people to get up and fly with it, rather than have the roofs brought down upon their brains. All through the night, the wind blows and abates not. But early in the morning, it begins to lull. From that time, with occasional wild charges like a wounded monster dying, it drops and sinks. And at full daylight, it is dead. It is then seen that the hands of the cathedral clock are torn off, and that some stones have been displaced upon the summit of the great tower. A cluster of early idlers gathers in Minor Canon Corner to watch the workmen who are investigating the damage. Their gazing eyes are brought down to earth by a loud voice calling to Canon Crisparkle to open his window.
Crisparkle! Where is my nephew?
Mr. Drood? He's not been here. Is he not with you?
No. He went down to the river last night with Mr. Neville to look at the storm and has not been back. Call Mr. Neville.
He left my house this morning early.
Left this morning early? Let me in at once! Let me in! Let me in!
Neville Landless had started so early on his walking tour and had walked at so good a pace that when the church bells began to ring in Cloisterham for morning service, he was 8 miles away. But he was overtaken and arrested by a band of men sent out from Cloisterham to capture him. After a considerable struggle, he was overcome and escorted back to the city.
Mr. Jasper, Mr. Crisparkle, what is this? What is the matter?
Where is my nephew?
Where is your nephew? Why do you ask me?
I ask you because you were the last person in his company and he's not to be found.
Not to be...
Not to be found?
I said not to be found, sir.
Mr. Jasper, if you'll allow me, Neville, try to collect your thoughts and attend to me.
I'll try, sir.
You left Mr. Jasper's lodging last night with Edwin Drood.
Yes.
At what time?
Was it 12 o'clock?
Quite right. Mr. Jasper's already told me it was 12 o'clock. You went down to the river together?
Yes, to watch the effect of the storm there.
How long did you stay there?
About 10 minutes, I should say, not more. And we walked together to your house, and he took leave of me at the door.
Did he say that he was going down to the river again?
No, he said he was going straight back.
What are those stains on Landless's coat?
Stains? What stains?
And here are the same stains upon his stick, the stick he carried last night. What does this mean?
In the name of God, say what it means, Neville.
Why, one of the men who set on me this morning had a struggle for the stick. That man there. Look, you can see the same blood stains on him, sir.
I think, Neville, we shall do well to call upon the mayor for an official investigation. You will be glad, of course, to clear yourself.
Of course.
Then let us be going. This way, Neville.
The official investigation produced no very satisfactory result. Mr. Sapsey, the mayor, expressed his opinion that the case had a dark look. In short, and here his eyes rested full on Neville's countenance, an un-English complexion. He wavered whether or no he should at once issue his warrant for the committal of Neville Landless to jail, under circumstances of grave suspicion. And he might have done so, but for the indignant protest of Canon Crisparkle, who undertook for the young man's remaining in his own house and being produced by his own hands whenever demanded. With the earliest light of next morning, men were at work upon dragging the river, and others were examining the banks. But no trace of Edwin Drood revisited the light of the sun.
Come in.
Good evening to you, Mr. Jasper.
Mr. Crugis, I was not aware you were in Cloisterham. Please, sit down.
This is strange news, I hear.
Strange and fearful news. You must excuse my unkempt appearance, but I've been out all day searching. How is your ward, Miss Rosa?
Poor little thing, you may imagine her condition.
Have you seen his sister?
His? Whose?
The suspected young man's.
Do you suspect him?
I don't know what to think. I cannot make up my mind.
Nor I, but you spoke of him as the suspected young man, so I thought you had made up your mind. I have just left Miss Landless.
What is her state?
Defiance of all suspicion and unbounded faith in her brother.
Poor thing.
However, it is not of her that I came to speak. It is of my ward, Miss Rosa. She has asked me to make you a communication that will surprise you. At least it has surprised me.
Well, what is it?
Shall I put it off till tomorrow? Mind, I warn you that I think it will surprise you.
You'd better tell me now, what is it?
This young couple, the lost youth at my ward, Miss Rosa,
yes,
though so
yes.
long betrothed, and so long recognizing their betrothal, and so near being married.
Well,
perhaps I'd better put this off till tomorrow, Mr. Jasper. You appear distressed.
No. Go on.
Well, then, this young couple came gradually to the discovery, made on both sides pretty equally, I think, that they would be happier and better as affectionate friends or as brother and sister than as husband and wife.
What?
You really look very pale, Mr. Jasper. Can I get you a glass of water or
no.
brandy, perhaps?
No, I'm all right, well enough. Go on.
And so this young couple formed the healthy resolution of exchanging their discoveries openly, sensibly, and tenderly. They met for that purpose and dissolved their betrothal.
When did they do this?
My ward has asked me to inform you that they kissed and parted on the very morning that you saw them last together.
Mr. Grugis paused. He saw before him no longer the ghastly figure with staring white face and quivering white lips which had confronted him throughout the interview. He saw nothing but a heap of torn and miry clothes upon the floor. And Mr. Grugis himself, wooden of aspect, opened and shut the palms of his hands as he warmed them at the fire, and he looked down at what lay at his feet. Some days later, it fell out that Canon Crisparkle, taking his early bathe in the river, discovered, caught in a corner of the weir, something that glistened brightly. A gold watch, engraved upon its back, ED, and near it, in the mud and ooze, a gold shirt bin. With these discoveries, he returned to Cloisterham and, taking Neville with him, went again straight to the mayor. Mr. Jasper was sent for, the jury identified. Neville was detained, and the wildest frenzy and fatuity of evil report arose against him. But no discovery was made which proved Edwin Drood to be dead,
and Neville was at length released. Then a consequence ensued which Canon Crisparkle had all too well foreseen.
The Canon Crisparkle.
Yes, Mr. Dean?
Human justice may but it must act according to its lights. The days of taking sanctuary are past. This young man must not take sanctuary with us.
You mean that he must leave my house, sir? If it be a necessity...
As you unfortunately find it to be...
It is hard to prejudge the case, sir, but I realize...
Just so perfectly. As you say, Canon Crisparkle, there is nothing else to be done.
I am entirely satisfied of his perfect innocence, sir, nevertheless. I hope you don't object, sir, to my having stated emphatically in public that he will reappear here whenever any new suspicion may be awakened or any new circumstances come to light.
Not at all. And yet, I don't think I would state it emphatically. In point of fact, Canon Crisparkle, keeping our hearts warm and our heads cool, we clergy need do nothing emphatically.
So Minor Canon Rowe knew Neville Landless no more, and he fled to London, where he took refuge at Staple Inn under the wing of Mr. Grewgious, with Helena at his side to comfort and support his exile. Befriended, too, by a neighbour of the name of Tartar, late to the Royal Navy, a handsome gentleman of 28, with a sunburnt visage, broad temples, bright blue eyes, and clustering brown hair. This agreeable apparition greeted Neville one summer night on his return to his chambers.
I do beg your pardon. Apologize for looking in so late.
Not at all.
If I may introduce myself, Tartar, corresponding sat next door. Beans, you know.
Beans?
Runners. Scarlet. Next door at the back.
Oh, I see. The roof garden.
The same. Now, I've noticed, if you'll excuse me, that you shut yourself up a good deal. And that you seem to like my garden aloft here. If you'd like a little more of it, I could throw out a few lines and stays between my windows and yours, which the runners would take to directly.
It's very kind of you.
Not at all. And I've some boxes of mignonette and wallflower that I could shove on along the gutter to your windows with a boat hook I have by me.
It'll be a great deal of trouble to you, I fear.
Not at all. A charity, in fact. Give me something to do. It would never do for a man who's been aboard ship from his boyhood to turn luxurious at once. I'd be very glad to take your windows in tow. Now, may I say good night and take the shortcut home through your window.
Mr. Tartar, pray come back from the window. It makes me giddy to see you.
But Mr. Tartar, with a wave of his hand and the deftness of a cat, had already gone below. And what of Cloisterham, while the summer days passed thus in Staple Inn? Round about this time, a stranger appeared in Cloisterham. A white-haired personage with black eyebrows, buttoned up in a tightish blue surtout, with something of a military air. This gentleman announced himself at the Crozier Hotel, where he put up, as an idle dog who lived upon his means. And he further announced that he had in mind to take a lodging in Cloisterham for a month or two, with a view to settling down there altogether.
I suppose, waiter, I suppose a fair lodging for a single butter might be found in these parts, eh?
I've no doubt of it, sir.
Something old. Take my hat down for a moment from that peg, will you?
Yes, sir.
No, I don't want it. Look into it. What do you see written there?
Datchery, sir.
Now you know my name. Dick Datchery. Hang the hat up again.
Yes, sir.
I was saying, something old is what I should prefer. Something odd and out of the way. Venerable. Architectural. And inconvenient.
We have a good choice of inconvenient lodgings in the town, sir, I think. Indeed, I've no doubt we could suit you that far, however particular you might be. But an architectural lodging? Oh, no, I couldn't say as to that.
Anything cathedral-y now?
I've got it, sir. Mr. Tope.
And who is Mr. Tope?
The verger at the cathedral, Mr. Tope is, sir, and his wife. Mrs. Tope, that is, lets lodgings or used to.
Then I'll call on Mrs. Tope after dinner. If you'll be so good as to direct me.
Certainly, sir.
But in spite of the waiter's directions, Mr. Datchery soon became bewildered and went boggling about the cathedral tower whenever he could catch a glimpse of it, with the general impression of his mind that Mr. Topes was somewhere very near it, and that he was warm in his search when he saw the tower and cold when he didn't see it. He was getting very cold indeed when he met with a hideous small boy throwing stones at a sheep.
Hey! You! Boy! Please torment him, that wretched animal, and show me the way to Mr. Tope.
How can I show you which is Tope's is when Tope's is as tell the story of the King Friedel and over the crossings and round ever so many corners, stupid? Yah!
Show me where it is, and I'll give you something.
Come on, then. Round this corner and down here. Weedy, weedy, wan. Or catches him out of the can. Weedy, weedy. There, look yonder. You see that there window and door?
Yes, that's Tope's.
You lie, it ain't. That's Jasper's.
Indeed, Jasper's, is it?
Yeah, and I ain't a go no nearer him, I tell you.
Why not?
Because I ain't a gonna be lifted off me legs and have me braces bust and be choked. Not if I knows it, and not by him. Wait till I set a jolly good flint a-flying at the back of his jolly old head someday. Now, look, tell us out of the door. That's Tope's, is it, with his name on a hovel plate.
Good. Now, see here, you owe me half of this shilling.
You lie. Oh, Dad, I owe nothing. I've never seen
you. I tell you, you owe me half of this because I have no sixpence in my pocket. So the next time you meet me, you shall do something else for me to pay me.
All right, give us out.
There you are, then. What's your name? Where do you live?
Deputy, Traveller's Company across the green.
Mr. Datchery found Mrs. Tope's terms moderate, and everything as quaintly inconvenient as he could desire. He agreed, therefore, to take the lodging there and then. Nothing could have exceeded his interest in his neighbours, especially in Mr. Jasper, who lived so near to his new lodging, and the afflicting history of that gentleman's recent loss. In fact, for a single buffer, living idly on his means, Mr. Datchery's life in Cloisterham might be considered remarkably busy. Cloisterham is bright and sunny these summer days. But there is grateful shade in the garden of the nun's house, where on a garden seat beside the sundial, Rosa receives a visitor. It is Mr. Jasper, clad in deep mourning.
Miss Rosa, I've been waiting to be summoned back to my duty near you.
Duty, sir?
The duty of teaching you, of serving you as your faithful music master.
I have left off that study.
And when will you resume it?
Never, sir.
Never? You could have done no more if you had loved my dear nephew.
I did love him, sir.
Yes, but not quite in the right way, shall I say.
I beg you not to question me any more. At all events, I won't answer any more.
Then I will not question you any more, but I will confess.
I don't wish to hear you, sir.
Sometimes we must act against our wishes. You must do so now, or do more harm to others than you can ever set right.
Harm? What harm?
Rosa, even when my dear boy was affianced to you, I loved you madly. Even when I strove to make him more ardently devoted to you, I loved you madly.
Oh, leave me at once, sir.
I told you that you must stay and hear me or do more harm than can ever be undone. I will tell you what harm. I've confessed to you that my love is mad. It is so mad that had the ties between me and my dear lost boy been less strong, I might have swept even him from your side when you favored him.
No.
Yes, even him. Judge then, Rosa, whether any other admirer whose life is in my hand shall love you and live.
Any other admirer? What do you mean, sir?
I mean to show you how mad my love is. Landis has confessed that he was my nephew's rival for your love, Rosa. And I hold the clue that shall entangle the murderer as in a net. A net that is slowly winding as I speak.
You cannot believe that Mr. Landis is a murderer.
But, sweet Rosa, circumstances may accumulate so strongly, even against an innocent man, that directed, sharpened, pointed, they may slay him.
If you really suppose that Mr. Landless has ever addressed himself to me, or that I favor him at all, you are wrong, quite wrong.
But at least you will hardly deny that his sister has become your bosom friend.
I love Helena dearly.
Then if you care for her peace of mind and her good name, remove the shadow of the gallows from her.
Dare propose to me to
you? Yes, I dare propose to you. My love for you is above all other love. If you were to cast me off now, I would pursue you to the death.
Rosa knew now that she must fly from this terrible man. She determined to take refuge with her guardian, Mr. Grewgious. And so that afternoon, with a few quite useless articles and a very little bag, she set out for Staple Inn.
Mr. Grewgious?
Rosa, my dear child, good heavens, come in.
Oh, Mr. Grewgious,
I'm so very glad to see you.
My dear child, come and sit down. What's happened? Who brought you here?
No one. I came alone.
Lord bless me. Why didn't you write to me to come and fetch you?
I took a sudden decision. Oh, poor Eddie. His uncle has been making love to me. And I've come to you, Mr. Grewgious, to protect me and all of us from him. If you will.
I will, damn him. Confound his politics, frustrate his knavish tricks. On thee his hopes to fix. Damn him again. There. I beg your pardon, my dear, but you'll be glad to know I feel better. Now, you must have some refreshment. Shall it be breakfast, lunch, dinner, tea or supper? Yes, my dear.
And always alone?
Always alone, except for Bazzard, my clerk.
He doesn't live here.
No, he goes his way after office hours. In fact, he's off duty here altogether just at present, and a firm downstairs has lent me a substitute. But it would be extremely difficult to replace Mr. Bazzard, extremely difficult.
He must be very fond of you.
I doubt if he is. You see, he's discontented, poor fellow.
Oh, why?
Well, he feels he's misplaced here. You see, my child, Mr. Bazzard has written a play, a tragedy.
Oh, how romantic. When is it to be performed?
Ah, that is the question. At present, nobody will hear of bringing it out on any account whatsoever.
Is the tragedy named yet, pray?
Strictly between ourselves, Rosa, it has a dreadfully appropriate name. It is called The Thorn of Anxiety. Oh. But Mr. Bazzard hopes, and I hope, that it will come out at last.
I hope so, too. Poor Mr. Bazzard.
And now, my dear, we must settle your affairs. Tonight I propose to take you over to Furnival's Inn, just across the way there. You'll be as safe as houses. There's a stout iron gate to keep out your persecutor, and Furnival's is fireproof, and I live over the way.
Dear Mr. Grewgious, I know I'm safe now.
Nothing occurred during the night to flutter the tired dove, and the dove arose refreshed and ready to join in the conference, which took place on the following morning, between Mr. Grewgious, Mr. Tartar, and Canon Crisparkle, who had come up from Cloisterham post-haste to set Miss Twinkleton's mind at rest about the welfare of her pupil. The result of this conference, Rosa was shortly able to confide to Helena, from whom she had been so long parted.
Came up this morning, and when he met Mr. Tartar, they recognized each other. And would you believe it, Helena? Mr. Tartar used to be his fag at school.
Oh, Rosa, what a wonderful coincidence.
Isn't it? And do you know, long ago, he saved his life.
I could believe anything noble of Canon Crisparkle.
Yes, but it wasn't Canon Crisparkle.
Oh.
I mean, it was very nice of Canon Crisparkle to be saved, and he couldn't have shown his high opinion of Mr. Tartar more expressively. But it was Mr. Tartar who saved him.
Oh, was it indeed?
Yes, Helena. And Mr. Tartar has very kindly given up his rooms to me. To us, I mean. So that if that terrible man tries to spy upon me or upon your brother, he will not be able to do so.
That is most kind of Mr. Tartar, I must say.
Oh, it is, Helena. He is so kind and so handsome. And Helena, his rooms are so beautiful you can't believe.
Really? In what way?
Oh, so tidy and neat and shining. All the brasswork polished like a mirror. And such curious, beautiful things Mr. Tartar has brought home from his voyages. And that dear little round window looking out into the garden.
Oh, dear me, it sounds delightful.
Oh, yes. It's like the inside of the most exquisite ship that ever sailed. It's like
a dream.
Oh, yes, Helena, like a dream.
Yes, my love. I see. But this arrangement is not permanent, Rosa. I mean, you will be going back one day to Cloisterham.
Oh, I could never go there anymore. I couldn't, indeed. Canon Crisparkle thinks Miss Twinkleton might like to come up and share a furnished lodging with me for a month or two. That might serve very well, I expect. But don't be uneasy, dear. I shall be sure to be somewhere.
So before very long, Rosa and Miss Twinkleton were established in furnished apartments in Southampton Street, Bloomsbury Square. While east of Bloomsbury Square, and still further eastward in London's Dockland, a man lies once more on that bed in that miserable, darkened room.
Here. Come here.
Yes, dearie. Want another of Princess Puffer's pipes, do you?
Well, I want to ask you something. Suppose you had something in your mind, something you were going to do.
Yes, dearie.
But had not quite determined to do, might or might not do, you understand?
Yes.
Should you do it in your fancy when you are lying here?
Oh, over and over again.
Just like me. I did it over and over again. I've done it hundreds of thousands of times in this room.
Well, it's to be hoped it was pleasant to do, dearie.
It was pleasant to do. It was a journey, a difficult, dangerous journey over abysses where a slip would be destruction. Look down. Look down. See what lies at the bottom there?
Yes, dearie. Well?
Well, I've told you. I did it here hundreds of thousands of times. I did it so often that when it was really done, seemed not worth the doing, it was done so soon.
Was there a fellow traveler on your journey, dearie?
Yes. To think how many times he went the journey and never saw the road. Hark.
Yes, dearie, I'm listening.
Shh. Journey's made. It's over. Been too short and easy. No struggle, no consciousness of peril, no entreaty. And yet I never saw that before.
What, dearie?
Look at it. Look what a poor, mean, miserable thing it is. That must be real. It's over. All over. So soon, all over.
So, asleep, my beauty. I heard you say once when I was lying where you're lying and you were making your speculations upon me. Unintelligible, I heard you say. But don't ye be too sure always. Don't ye be too sure, beauty.
Late that same evening in Cloisterham, Mr. Datchery sat writing at his open window by the postern gate, eyeing all who passed as if he were toll-taker of a gateway. He appeared to take little note of the homecoming of his neighbour, Mr. Jasper, but his eye brightened at the appearance shortly after of a tattered apparition in a shabby shawl who had paused at the foot of Mr. Jasper's staircase. He calls to her through his open window.
Hello, my friend. Who are you looking for?
For a gentleman who passed in here this minute, sir.
Well, what do you want with him?
Where do we live, dearie?
Live? Why, up that staircase.
Oh, bless ye, don't speak so loud, dearie. What's his name?
Surname, Jasper. Christian name, John. Mr. John Jasper.
Is he a calling, good gentleman?
Calling? Yes. Sings in the choir.
In the spire?
Choir! Oh. In the cathedral choir! Go to service there at 7 tomorrow morning, and you may see Mr. John Jasper and hear him, too.
Thank you, dearie. Thank you. I'll do that.
A brilliant morning shines on the old city. Inside the cathedral, the stone tombs of centuries grow warm, and flecks of brightness dart into the sternest marble corners of the building, fluttering there like wings. When Mr. Datchery at length discerns the Princess Puffer, she is seated behind the pillar, out of Jasper's view, but watching him with the closest attention. Unconscious of her presence, he chants and sings. She grins when he is most musically furtive, and yes, Mr. Datchery sees her do it, shakes her fist at him behind the pillar's friendly shelter. When the service comes to an end, Mr. Datchery accosts his new acquaintance outside.
Morning, my friend. Well, did you see him?
I seen him, dearie, I seen him.
And you know him?
Know him? better far than all the reverend parsons together know him. Better far.
Mrs. Tope has spread a very neat, clean breakfast ready for her lodger. Before sitting down to it, he opens the door of a corner cupboard, takes a piece of chalk, and adds one thick line to several already there, from the top of the cupboard door to the bottom.
There. I like the old tavern way of keeping scores. Illegible, except to the scorer. The scorer, not committed. The scored, debited with what is against him. Very satisfactory. Ooh, I'm forgetting.
Very satisfactory.
That's the idea. That's the voice.
And Mr. Datchery falls too with an appetite. At that point in the story of The Mystery of Edwin Drood, Dickens laid down his pen. The next day, he was dead. The book unfinished. The mystery doomed to remain a mystery forever. For more than 90 years, suggestions have been made as to how he could possibly have meant the story to end. Here is one. We return to Cloisterham in the months following the last episode. No conclusive evidence against Jasper has been discovered, in spite of the detective efforts of Mr. Bazzard, for, as you may have surmised, Mr. Dick Datchery was none other than Mr. Grewgious's dramatically minded clerk, satisfying with a white wig and dyed eyebrows the frustrated ambitions of a lifetime. But Mr. Bazzard had been busy, nor had Jasper himself been idle. Jasper's malignity against Neville Landless pursued that unhappy man to London, and there, by anonymous letters, indirect threats and secret persecution, he so preyed upon Neville's mind that he sapped his health. Helena Landless, calling upon her brother one day in November, was shocked to see his pale face and bright, staring eyes.
Helena!
Neville, my dearest, you are ill.
Oh, no, Helena, I'm well enough, as well as I shall ever be. Mine is a sickness of the mind, not the body.
You have had another communication from that terrible man. I know it, Neville.
Yes. By today's post, I received a letter from Mr. Jasper. Oh. It summons me to Cloisterham. I'm to attend an investigation of Edwin Drood's disappearance.
But they cannot accuse you of a crime you have not committed. You are as innocent as I.
I know it, Helena. Jasper knows it. But innocent or guilty, the shadow of the gallows is upon me.
The inquiry which Jasper had instigated took place at the end of November. Canon Crisparkle was reluctantly forced to repeat his damaging evidence, and other witnesses were called to reaffirm what they had already told of Landless's behavior at the time of the disappearance. But the climax of the investigation was the opening of the Sapsea vault and the discovery that was made therein.
Believe me, Mr. Sapsea, I would not have urged the desecration of this vault had I not felt that it might bring us nearer to the knowledge of my dear boy's fate.
This here door's open already, Mr. Jasper.
Open, but I... Are you sure, Dedos?
He didn't need no turning anyway. Now, give us that lantern.
Dedos, what can you see?
Looks like a heap of my quicklime from the graveyard.
What else? What else? What is that?
Some bits of cloth, eaten away with the lime.
That's my boy's coat.
Look, Mr. Jasper. Look what's lying there. A gold ring.
A ring? But Edwin never wore a ring.
Stop there, Mr. Jasper. I can identify that ring. I myself gave that to Edwin Drood.
And so an innocent jewel brought to his death an innocent man. For that night, Neville Landless, distraught in his mind, took his own life by poison. But Helena Landless, believing always in the innocence of her brother, determined to shock Jasper into a confession. She had discovered that Princess Puffer had a strong personal motive for revenge on John Jasper. For in the past, he had wronged her daughter, and the child, deputy, unknown to Jasper, was the result. Therefore, Helena arranged that Princess Puffer should summon Jasper to the Sapsea tomb on Christmas Eve, the anniversary of the crime. And there, before hidden witnesses, Mr. Datchery, Canon Crisparkle, and Mr. Grewgious, She was to accuse him of the murder of Edwin Drood. His nerves were to be further shaken by the apparition of his other victim, Neville, which apparition was, of course, to be Helena disguised in her brother's clothes. And so, on Christmas Eve, when the moonlight made phantoms of the very gravestones, John Jasper came to the Sapsea vault, alone, and unconscious of the watchers among the graves.
He's coming. Canon Crisparkle, Mr. Grewgious, be ready to creep closer.
Is anyone there?
I'm here, dearie. Princess Puffer's here. Was me you were looking for, wasn't it? Not anybody else.
Yes, yes, not the loud woman. Come inside the vault where we shall not be overheard. Don't shut the door. It's close in here, clammy, like the chill of death. Now, quickly, what have you to say to me?
Say to you, dearie, why only what I asked you for? Was it me you looked for to meet here, or some other?
Why do you ask these idiot questions? For yourself, as you know. Who else should I look for in this place and at this time?
I thought as it might be one you met in this place and at this time a year ago tonight, dearie.
Be careful what you say, woman. Can't be not too far if you would leave this place alive. A very little more and my hands would fasten round that lying throat of yours.
As they did around mine, eh, Uncle?
What's that? Who spoke?
Your beloved and long-lost nephew, Edwin Drew, returned from the grave.
No, no, keep it off. Don't let it near me.
Well, dear uncle, aren't you going to shake hands?
Keep off! Your hands are burning! Let me out! Let me out!
After him, quickly! He's making for the tower!
Jasper rushed from the vault, sometimes reeling aside from his path, but always running, running from the terrible thing behind him. Edwin, the living Edwin, had joined Datchery and Grewgious in the pursuit, while Canon Crisparkle remained beside the unconscious form of Helena, who had arrived in time to see Edwin confront Jasper and had thereupon swooned with horror. To the foot of the tower they followed him, and up the winding stone stairs. As he climbed, they climbed, gaining steadily but still behind.
We've almost got him.
Uncle! Wait! Stop!
Too late. He's thrown himself over.
May the Lord have mercy on his soul.
There is little more to tell. Edwin's explanation made next day when the terrors of the night had subsided was a strangely simple one. Jasper's attempt at murder had failed because in his haste and nervous excitement he had only succeeded in rendering Edwin unconscious. Easy enough, for the wine Edwin had drunk at supper that night had been drugged. Jasper threw what he thought to be the corpse of Edwin Drood upon the heap of quicklime, then rushed from the vault, forgetting in his agitation to relock it. He then made for the weir and threw in Edwin's watch and shirt pin, knowing that gold would not be destroyed by quicklime.
The first thing I knew was a sharp burning pain in my right hand. That brought me round pretty quickly, I can tell you. I was on my feet and off that pile of quicklime like a flash.
But why did you leave the ring behind, Edwin?
To tell the truth, I forgot it. It was in the pocket of my greatcoat, which was badly burned by the lime. I pulled my coat off and left it behind me. And then, well, I simply opened the door and walked out and made the best of my way to the railway station.
And so to London and Egypt?
Yes.
But why did you not call upon me, Edwin, and save us all this anxiety?
I thought of nothing but escape, Mr. Grewgious.
I see.
And the horror in my mind was such that once away from Cloistrum, I dared not reveal to any of my friends that I still lived. It was only a short while ago, on my return from Egypt, that I met the old opium woman again in London, the one who warned me before. She it was who begged me to come back last night.
You frightened us all very badly, my boy.
I know, and I'm deeply sorry. As for my uncle, I still cannot believe in what he did, nor that he's dead.
His dying confession left us in no doubt as to his motives, nor as to the unbalanced condition of his mind. Perhaps that is some little consolation to you, Edwin.
It will not bring him back to me as he was, Mr. Crisparkle, nor bring Neville Landless back to his sister.
As to that, I had not meant to make the announcement on this occasion, but I am nonetheless happy to tell you that last night Miss Landless promised to become my wife.
Oh, congratulations.
My dear Crisparkle, I wish you both every happiness, and I admire your choice.
Thank you, my dear Edwin. You will stay to dinner with us?
I'm much obliged to you, but I fear I cannot.
Oh.
I have an engagement for Christmas dinner at the Crozier with my wife.
Your wife?
I knew you'd be surprised. I met her in Egypt. We were married 3 months ago.
I'm impatient for the opportunity to admire your choice, Edwin.
And as for Rosa, she and my Georgina will be sisters to each other on sight.
And strangely enough, they were. Rosa, of course, became Mrs. Tartar and began her blissfully happy married life in the Dreamship quarters at Staple Inn, while Helena Landless, when her term of mourning was over, became Mrs. Crisparkle and the ornament and pride of Minor Canon Corner. And there, as the Christmas bells ring out a happy chime, and the red berries shine again in the lattices, let us leave them. Peace on earth, goodwill to men, say the bells. For the shadow of evil has lifted from Cloisterham, and the light of that first Christmas day shines once more on its ancient walls.
That was The Mystery of Edwin Drood, the unfinished novel by Charles Dickens, adapted for broadcasting by Molly Hardwick, with a suggested ending. The story was told, with the words of Charles Dickens, by Francis DeWolfe. The part of John Jasper was played by John Gabriel, Edwin Drood, his nephew, by Malcolm Terris, Rosabud by Rosalind Shanks, Neville Landless by Nigel Graham, and Helena Landless by Isabel Rennie. Mr. Grewgious, the lawyer, was played by Dennis Blakelock, and Bazzard, his clerk, who became in this version Mr. Dick Datchery, by Brian Olson. The Dean of Cloisterham was played by Hamlin Benson, Canon Crisparkle by Patrick Barr, Mr. Tope the Verger by Timothy Harley, who also played a waiter at the Crozier Hotel. Princess Puffer was played by Mary Wimbush, Durdles the Stonemason by John Boxer, Deputy by Gordon Gardner, a jeweler by Stephen Thorne, Lieutenant Tartar by David Valor. The production, which was recorded, was by Raymond Rakes.